You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler, September the 25th, 2015. First weekend of fall coming up. Glad to have you join me. Hope you all had a wonderful week. And there is much to catch up on. So, again, I thank you for being here. No place I'd rather be on a Friday evening than sharing an hour with you and holding to the format that I've decided to continue to go with. This will be a 60-minute program, an hour. It's the Michael Cutler Hour. I decided that it should be actually an hour instead of 90 minutes. So there, we have discounted it. To those of the Jewish faith, I hope you have a happy, healthy New Year. This is the beginning of the new year. And no matter how you measure the year, I hope it is one that brings peace, happiness, and health to all of you. You know, those of you familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the old INS. And since the attacks of 9/11, I have done everything in my power to wake up our leaders, to wake up our citizens to the real significance of our immigration system. You know, it's always been portrayed as an insignificant issue, about dishwashers and people putting roofs on houses, and we're a nation of immigrants, and we've heard all this business. The reality is that our borders and our immigration laws are our first and last line of defense. Defense against international terrorists, defense against transnational criminal gangs, defense against aliens whose presence in our country would be harmful to us. It's not about xenophobia. Our immigration laws have nothing to do with race, religion, ethnicity, and everything to do with keeping out those folks who, again, would pose us a threat. And in fact, if you go to, and this isn't going to be a law lesson, but if you go to Title 8, United States Code Section 811, Title 8, United States Code Section 811, you could see the categories of aliens who we're supposed to keep out. It's aliens with dangerous diseases, aliens who are criminals, aliens who are mentally ill, terrorists, spies, human rights violators, war criminals, and those who would take our jobs and in so doing drive down wages and displace American workers. And I want to keep reminding people about it because I was listening to the Pope today, and certainly his coming to the United States is getting an awful lot of press coverage. This whole business about, you know, we've got to take in the immigrants. And what concerns me is that what our country all too often winds up doing by permitting millions of people from third world countries such as Mexico to come to the United States is to actually enable the abusers in their home countries to continue to get away with the lunacy that they have been foisting on their own people. You know, Mexico is a very economically successful country. Carlos Slim is the wealthiest man on the planet. He lives in Mexico, and he is a citizen of Mexico. There is an oligarchy in Mexico that controls the wealth of that country with an iron fist. A tiny group of people in Mexico control the vast amount of wealth of that nation. And what America has become is a safety valve for that oligarchy, propping them up, distracting the citizens of Mexico. We have at least 10% of Mexico now living inside the United States. So those young, able-bodied men who are doing the physically demanding jobs in the United States would likely be demanding change in their own country if they could not be here. So I think we really need to consider compassion from a perhaps slightly different angle. How compassionate is it for the United States prop up a corrupt oligarchy? That's the question that I would love to ask those people who raise the issue of compassion and people from countries such as Mexico. Why don't we look at the broader issue? Working in America for minimum wage is not the American dream. Never has been, never was supposed to be, never will be. So this idea that we act as a safety valve so that the people that would be demanding change in their home country are otherwise occupied here inside the United States and often being exploited terribly. When I began my career with the old Immigration and Naturalization Service, before I was assigned to DEA intelligence, before I was assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, I raided factories. I raided building sites, construction sites. We went out there and we simply arrested aliens who were illegally present in the United States. What a novel thought. No, we did not tap them on the shoulder, Governor Christie. We arrested them. I thought it was remarkable, and we'll get to that later, that Governor Christie said that when people overstay the visa, we need to tap them on the shoulder. Tough prosecutor Christie. You know, you got to laugh sometimes, or you're going to cry when you hear the nonsense that comes out of the mouths of our alleged leaders. But I saw the exploitation, the women in the sweatshops, the men at the work sites. This is not the American dream. This is not showing respect for fellow human beings. This is, in very many cases, indentured servitude, and it's got to stop. And the only way it stops is by making it clear that the United States has borders and immigration laws, and first and foremost, the needs of the American people have to come first. But this would also force countries such as Mexico to deal with their own people far more equitably. That's really what we should be pushing for. The solution to world poverty isn't to bring the world to the United States. The United States is struggling terribly. We have 93 million working-aged adults who are either unemployed or severely underemployed, and the solution is not to bring another couple of billion people here, because there are billions of people, at the risk of sounding like the late, great Carl Sagan, there are billions of people in the world living below the poverty level. Bringing them to the United States is the functional equivalent of overloading a lifeboat. Overload a lifeboat, it sinks. This lifeboat, known as the United States of America, is sinking. If you look at the national debt, if you look at the level of poverty, if you consider that one in four American children now lives below the poverty line, if you realize that student loans have gotten to the point of the preposterous, the second greatest form of indebtedness by the average American or the average American family, student loans, it amounts to more than $1.2 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars. And yet we have politicians talking about the need to bring in the best and brightest from around the world. We have over 400,000 foreign students in the United States right now studying the STEM curriculum, science, technology, engineering, and math. And politicians who have the unmitigated chutzpah to make the recommendation that when we educate these kids, we should let them stay here and take the jobs, even as HP just laid off 30,000 high-tech workers, programmers, scientists, engineers, and so forth. A couple of months back, or almost a year ago now, the time does go quickly, Silicon Valley canned 20,000, Disney 500, and the list goes on and on. And if you keep digging around, you'll find more and more evidence of this. We are firing Americans and displacing them with foreign workers. And we're told that this is about compassion. We are told this is about compassion. Why is it that compassion never, ever applies to the poor American family? And why is it that the race card is always thrown out as soon as you say, let's enforce the immigration laws? So those of you who think this is racist, why don't you look at the poverty levels of American black families? Look at the poverty level of American Latino families, and look at how the nonsense being spewed by alleged journalists who talk about the Latino vote have the world convinced that all Latinos are alike, and then they talk about the black vote, so all blacks are alike, and then they talk about the Jewish vote, because we all know that all Jews are alike, and we have everybody in the United States bamboozled into believing that Latinos are lawless, don't care about our national sovereignty or our national security, which is a big fat lie. We have everybody convinced that the only people who are illegally present in the United States are Latinos and probably from Mexico. Consider how many tens of millions of Americans are Latino ethnicity, perhaps multi-generational Americans, perhaps lost members of their families to military service to our nation or to law enforcement efforts, which to me is no different. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. It's got to stop. Both Reagan and Eisenhower felt that hyphenating Americans and then trying to appeal to segments of the society that way was dangerous and anti-American, and they could not agree more. America is about Americans. What does the average American look like? The average American comes in all flavors, all sizes, all shapes, all ethnicities, all religions, all colors. That's what makes America so damn great. The fact that we do have a diverse population, the fact that people were able to come to America and build for themselves and future generations the American dream that is now being stolen from us by the very wealthy, by the corporations, by those who have trying to and succeeding in becoming America's oligarchs, aided and abetted by corrupt politicians. Forgive the redundancy of using the word corrupt and politician in the same sentence. Now, not all are bad. Jeff Sessions should be running for president. If I had a magic wand, I'd love to see Jeff Sessions sitting in the Oval Office tomorrow morning and not as a visitor. There are other good people. I had the distinct privilege of meeting Trey Gowdy over this past week when I was in South Carolina, and that's what we're going to focus on, is South Carolina. And I think Gowdy is a good guy. He chairs the House Immigration Subcommittee. He was very gracious when I met him at an event sponsored by Republican women in South Carolina, just outside Spartanburg. There were good people. My friend Lou Barletta from Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Chuck Grassley, Jim Vitter in the Senate. There are some. So, you know, when people say term limits, I say, listen, as Americans, we have to have the smarts to impose our own term limit in the voting booth. I would not want to see Jeff Sessions out of the Senate unless it was to be in the White House. Then I'd accept him out of the Senate. So I don't want to throw away the baby with the bathwater. But most of these politicians are beholden to the corrupting influence of money, which is why Donald Trump is scaring the crap out of so many of these career politicians and lobbyists and all the others. He knows how the game is played. For years he played that game, and now he's turned around, and I guess I can't speak for Donald Trump, and I'm not advocating his presidency. But just listening to what he says, you know, it's a long way away before I endorse anybody's candidacy. But I do find it remarkable that he says, I'm very rich and I don't need anybody's money. So the people who are used to going out and buying candidates, truly buying candidates, don't know what to do about Donald Trump, the man who apparently can't be bought or rented for that matter. Kind of remarkable. So, you know, when we listen to this business about let's be compassionate, charity begins at home, compassion begins at home, and long run, if you really want to fix what's wrong with the lives of Mexicans, let's fix Mexico. Let's fix Mexico. Let's make certain that when people are Mexicans in their own country, that they have the opportunity to create their own Mexican dream. And that's not going to happen if we keep using America as the safety valve for Mexico and other countries. That is not going to work. That is absolutely not going to work. All that this does is keep the young, able-bodied men who should be storming the gates in Mexico in the United States where they can't get into mischief. That's what we're doing, folks. and it's about as immoral as it gets. Mexico needs to fix Mexico. Instead of demanding that we feed and educate and take medical care of their citizens, they need to do it. They need to do it. And yes, there are some third world countries that are in horrific condition, and you know, they're not in that position. But the Mexican economy is somewhere around number 16 or 17 in the world. In the world. And you're going to tell me that the only solution for Mexicans to live a decent life is to come to the United States? That is lunacy. And nobody ever stops to raise the question. Why are we backing up the oligarchy of the country of Mexico? Why are we taking pressure off those corrupt oligarchs in Mexico? The solution is to tell the people of Mexico, fix your government. Time to give Mexicans opportunities in their own country. They are conscientious. They are hardworking. They are decent people. I have tremendous respect for them as an agent when I encountered them. In fact, one of the people I worked with, his name was Juan, extremely helpful to me. He ultimately got his citizenship. He helped me with a bunch of my investigations. These are great people. When I enforced the immigration laws, it wasn't about bigotry. It was about enforcing the laws. And I can tell you that it is not compassionate to give menial jobs to millions of people from a country that should be able to provide ample opportunities for their own citizens. Time to wake up. Time to set that alarm clock and hear it clanging. We can't feed the world. We can't clothe the world. We can't house the world. If we're going to talk about setting standards and creating examples, let us make an example out of Mexico. They have the resources, they have the conscientious people, they have everything they need for Mexicans to live the Mexican dream inside their own borders. That's my thought for the day. Now, turning to South Carolina, there is a program underway to resettle refugees across the country in welcoming communities. South Carolina, Spartanburg, has been named one of those welcoming communities. The people of Spartanburg aren't particularly happy. They don't know who's being admitted into their community. And that's a real concern. I've been writing about it for the longest time. The 9/11 Commission warned about all these programs, whether it's political asylum, refugees, and so forth. When you bring people to the United States from parts of the world where terrorists are operating, there is a better than even chance that at least some of those people headed your way are terrorists. This is an old story. In fact, it was really interesting, but one of the later Star Wars movie even made reference to terrorists hiding in refugees. It actually happened in the Star Wars movie. So, I mean, people get it. People get it. And then we're being told, well, they're going to be vetted. They're going to be screened. You know, there was a journalist in England who wrote a very disturbing report about a week ago. I believe he was writing for the Daily Mail. And he was able to purchase a legitimate Syrian passport with his photograph on it, but in the name of a deceased Syrian. He got a matching driver's license and an ID card that Syrians are supposed to carry with them wherever they go when they're walking around their own country. So for $2,000, he acquired all this documentation, and it would stand up to scrutiny because it was a legitimate passport. ISIS has overrun government office buildings in Syria. They have stolen blank passports. They stole the printing machine, so you're using the same equipment to produce the passport that the bureaucrats would use under normal circumstances. How hard would it then be for somebody to acquire a false name, enter Europe or enter the United States claiming to be somebody they were not? And in fact, there have been other articles about how many people aren't even from Syria. They're from all sorts of countries. And there was one guy that wrote about it and said, when you listen to the accents, you realize that many of these people aren't from Syria. This is a hodgepodge of people from around the world, a part of the world that cranks out terrorists quicker than McDonald's cranks out hamburgers. and I want you to think about something. A couple of weeks ago, we made note of the 14th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. Now, just imagine what 19 terrorists not only did to the United States, but to the entire world. Think about the two terrorists, the Tsarnaev brothers, who wreaked such havoc on the Boston Marathon on April 15th, 2013, just a year and a half ago. Understand the dangers that we face by people who either aren't properly vetted or whatever happens to them, but we're not talking about huge numbers of people. The Second World War for the United States began when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Think how many pilots and sailors and all the people that were involved in that massive attack on Pearl Harbor. You probably had thousands of people from Japan, Japanese military, behind that attack. The number of people killed at Pearl Harbor, if you don't know it, folks, is about 3,000. The number of people who were slaughtered on 9/11 was about 3,000. In fact, I would argue it's more than that because of all the people who subsequently died because of their exposure to the toxins when the buildings came down, and more people are still terribly ill. These people have been suffering ever since the day that the airplanes were used as cruise missiles to take the towers down. So isn't it remarkable that 19 terrorists were able to inflict, I would argue, more casualties than the Japanese Navy on December 7th, 1947? In this era of what's known as asymmetrical warfare, a handful of terrorists can inflict huge numbers of casualties. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people ultimately that are going to be on the move coming out of Syria and the Middle East, so that if even only 1% are terrorists, that is a huge number with a horrific potential for devastation. That's my concern. My concern, and it's the concern that I voiced when I went before the county council in Spartanburg, and I have to tell you, what I witnessed at that council was nothing short of disgusting, despicable, infuriating, and outrageous. I guess you get the sense I wasn't having a good time. And it wasn't the fault of the citizens or the residents of Spartanburg. The night before, I addressed a packed room, a cafeteria in a high school. It was jammed to the rafters. I have traveled around the country and done speaking events where I was happy if 55, 60, 65 people show up. That cafeteria had hundreds of people. They had traveled from across the state. And it was interesting because initially they were concerned because I didn't only talk about the refugee crisis. Because people need to understand that the immigration system has been failing for a long time. You know, we hear it's broken. What's broken about the immigration system is we don't have enough agents. We have an administration that won't enforce the law. We have politicians from both political parties providing every possible word of encouragement imaginable. The debate today isn't about whether or not we're going to deport people, but it's about whether or not we should give them just work authorization or citizenship. This is nuts. We're talking about illegal aliens getting into the country. And then you have the Republicans saying, well, we just want to give them permission to work. And the Democrats are saying, oh, no, we have to give them citizenship. Folks, we admit more than a million lawful immigrants every year, more than the rest of the world combined. We naturalize hundreds of thousands of new citizens. I think 2 years ago it was something on the order of 600,000 or 700,000. Generally, it's at least 500,000. And, of course, Hillary Clinton comes out and lies. Hard to imagine, isn't it, that Hillary would lie? I mean, what was I thinking? But anyway, it appeared she was lying. I say that's tongue firmly embedded in my cheek. I may need to get a crowbar to pry it out. She said that the Republicans don't want the immigrants to vote. No, Hillary. And I'm a Democrat, by the way, and I'm embarrassed that she is part of the Democratic Party. Very embarrassed, I don't mind telling you. I feel disgraced every time I look at some of these characters, but I'm sure my Republican friends look at the nitwits on the Republican side and don't feel any less nausea than I do when I look at the Democrats. They all make me sick, with those exceptions that we talked about. But she is talking about illegal aliens voting. I want everyone to stop and think about what she was talking about. Because there are members of the Republican Party, like Jeff Sessions, who said, no, we shouldn't be giving these people lawful status. We shouldn't be giving them citizenship. Oh, they don't want them to vote. They're illegal aliens. What other country on the face of the screwball planet would have leaders, a candidate for the presidency, talking about giving the vote to illegal aliens? If that isn't enough to turn your stomach and make your head spin like the rotor blades on a helicopter, I don't know what will do it for you. But this is the level of the lies, the deceit, the fraud being foisted on us by our supposed leaders. But as Hillary herself might say, what difference does it make? It's astonishing. So the people of Spartanburg had me speak, and they were very receptive. Some were disappointed. Why did you speak about more than the refugee issue? And I said, you need to understand that the immigration system lacks the integrity to know who we are admitting. And that was what the 9/11 Commission warned about, this lack of integrity to the overall immigration system. By the next day, when they had the opportunity to digest it, I think even those people that were concerned about why I provided so much background information, you know, it's like in a war, there are the long-term causes and then there's the immediate cause. Same thing here, you know. The Second World War, all sorts of things were happening, but it took the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor to spring us into the war. You see things like that. The Bay of Tonkin Resolution got us into the Vietnam War. There's always that spark that ignites the thing. But there's usually long-standing situations that precede. Well, immigration has been about cheap labor, about unlimited tourists, unlimited students, all about the money. It's all about the money, and it's still all about the money. And then again, it's about the money. Remarkable, the selling of our country. So I thought it was important for the people in the audience to understand how dysfunctional the immigration system is. And it was interesting because when Trey Gowdy addressed this group of Republican women the following night, that was one of the points he talked about. He said we should be looking back 20 years to see what happened when prior situations, when refugees were admitted into the United States, how many assimilated, how many became involved in crime, how many became involved in terrorism, and look at the overall immigration system and its ability to carry out its work. And Trey was right on the money. And I got to tell you, I'm thrilled to death that Trey Gowdy chairs the House Immigration Subcommittee. There was another gentleman who had chaired that committee previously, John Hostetler, who unfortunately lost his bid for re-election. John called upon me, I think, 8 or 9 times to testify before the subcommittee back then. So I certainly think Trey Gowdy, prosecutor, is a worthy successor. He tends to call me special agent. I sometimes think instead of congressman, maybe I should call him prosecutor. But I do have confidence that he's trying to do the right thing. And, in fact, he told me that he's trying to greatly increase the number of special agents to do interior enforcement of our immigration laws, and he's on to something, because that's what nobody talks about. And finally, it's the chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee, no less, talking about the need for many more agents. There is the solution that we have, and then we need to decide on how to deploy them most effectively and so forth. But we do need boots on the ground, and finally we're getting a leader in Congress who says, yeah, we need those boots, and put agents in them. By the way, don't just put shoes on the floor. I lose my sense of humor. My mind can't be far behind. But when I went before the council, what the folks wanted to do, the residents of Spartanburg, because they only get 30 minutes to address their council, you got to love it that there's a time limit, 30 minutes. God knows their time is precious, these geniuses. And so the folks in Spartanburg who brought me down there, paid the airfare so I could be there, said, look, we will yield our time to you, and so you will have 30 minutes, Mr. Cutler. Spoken to some members of this 7-person panel, and they said, oh, one of them had said, yeah, it looks like we can do that. Okay, we're all set. I get into the auditorium. Chairman is there, and he's rattling off a whole bunch of bills about how they were going to close this street and open that street and pave that road and everybody congratulated each other and all the people that they had hired, new commissioner for solid waste management and all this other usual stuff that goes on at these meetings, and they've done enough of these around the country. And then he said, we're going to get to this issue about the resettlement. And he called the first person who was signed up to testify. And the person stood up and said, I yield my time to Mike Cutler. And the guy got nastier than hell, the chairman. And he said, no, you won't. No, you won't. Mr. Cutler is getting 3 minutes, no more than 3 minutes. And if you want to yield your time, then you can sit down. So there was a lot of consternation from the members of the community who showed up at this event. The room was packed to the rafters as well. This is a hot issue. There were camera crews there. There were reporters who were there. There's a lot of concern about all this. And it was remarkable because this guy would not change his mind no matter what. So I had to quickly shift gears because I had expected to get up there. I thought I was going to have 30 minutes. I had planned to read a couple of quick quotes out of the 9/11 Commission report, because that is the bottom line here. It's about national security. That's why I traveled to Spartanburg. You know, one of the things I said when I testified for John Hostetler when he chaired the House Immigration Subcommittee, and it was a remarkable story behind that, I had a reporter from Ohio contact me, and he wanted to know about the Somalia guy that was going to blow up the mall in Ohio, and this was maybe a year after 9/11, and he called me up. And he said, you know, they blew up the building in New York, but that was New York. This is Ohio. My wife shops in the mall with my children. And this schmo apparently didn't realize that my cell phone number, which begins with the numbers 917, which was a fairly new number 14 years ago, was a New York number. And I'll spare you the language, but I have to tell you, my head was spinning like a top. I'm probably fortunate the guy wasn't in front of me at the time. I probably would have, you know, had a fist fight with him. I was so damn angry. I said, what do you mean they blew up the buildings in New York, but this is Ohio? I said, you dumb idiot. This is America. And how do you just write off New York? I said, I live in New York. The ashes landed on my home. My neighbors died. But I would be no less upset if it was the Sears Tower. I know they've renamed it. I don't remember what the new name of it is. But I'd be just as angered if it was the Sears Tower that came down instead of the World Trade Center. We're Americans. America was attacked. And I hung up on the idiot. And so I went before Congress and I said, no American city is safe if any American city is attacked. And I quoted myself at that hearing before the county council. And I said, if you're letting people into your community, they could easily make their way from here to New York, to Chicago, to Los Angeles, to Miami. You know, as Americans, the concern must first and foremost be that we don't permit terrorists to have easy access to our country and to our people. That's why I'm concerned. It's not about what the religion is of the refugees. It's nothing more than, I don't know who you are. And when you ask State Department about the vetting process, they give you all this mumbo-jumbo, well, we have a seven-step thing in place, and listen, we know what the story is, and I'll read you something about the way we're vetting people in Syria. But what I said to the council was, you know, Tip O'Neill, the late Speaker of the House of Representatives, was known for constantly reminding people that at the end of the day, all politics is local. And I told the county council that having been a law enforcement officer, having been a federal agent for 30 years, I bear witness to the fact that all law enforcement is also local. On September 11, 2001, while America was most definitely attacked, by nightfall, the rubble on a corner or a series of corners, you know, a segment of lower Manhattan, covered with the remains of the victims and of the buildings that had stretched a quarter of a mile into the sky, was a local issue. Hundreds of New York's first responders, firefighters, police officers, Port Authority people, died. America was attacked, but at the end of the day, the attack took place in my hometown. and it resulted in an airplane crashing in a bucolic field in Pennsylvania, and to the devastation that was brought to the Pentagon. These are specific locations in specific American cities. And I said, what you seem to have forgotten, you being the council, these geniuses, is that you bear responsibility for the safety and the people of the people in your community. And if you err, and if there is a terrorist attack because this program fails to vet people, you personally will bear the responsibility. It will be on you. You will be the one trying to explain it away, and you will not be able to. And you will not be able to. And I explained my background. I said, I'm not anti-refugee. I think I've spoken about it here on my program in the past. When I was back in high school, back in college, I was the president of a B'nai B'rith group, which is a Jewish service organization. We did a lot of charitable work. We worked with St. Jude's Hospital. Danny Thomas left one hell of a legacy with his hospital that cares for sick children. We would go out there every year and collect as much money as possible to contribute to the growth of St. Jude's Hospital. My goodness, Danny Thomas to me stood bigger than life because of that. Not because he was an entertainer, but because of his commitment to that hospital. I get choked up just thinking about it. And so we tried to do what was right. And one of the things that we did to try to do that was right was to go to the LBJ, Lyndon Johnson White House. He was the president back then, to convince him to get the Russians to allow Jews and other religious minorities to leave Russia, come to America, go to any country that would have them. I felt that that was the best good deed. That's the concept in Judaism. The word for it is a mitzvah, a good deed, was to get people out of that regime and get them to a place where they would be safe, free from tyranny, able to practice their religious beliefs. Because we were part of a Jewish organization, the primary concern were Jews, but we didn't care. Any religion. The idea was to give people the freedom to worship as they wanted to. And when I got the opportunity as an inspector to admit refugees, it was a joyous day for me. You can't imagine what joy it gave me to see the wheel go full circle, to participate in the demonstrations, to have LBJ give us his commitment that he'd do his best, and then to sit at that booth at Kennedy Airport and admit refugees warmed my heart. We literally had people walk into the terminal from the airplane, fall to their knees, and kiss the floor of the building. I kid you not. We had people walk into my booth and kiss me on my cheek or hug me or cry. And I cried with them. And I would still feel the same way if there was integrity to the process, but there is not. And that's the issue. Syria is a country that is in turmoil. Al-Assad of Syria is not our ally. He will not help us vet the people that are leaving. He has no interest in helping us. If he could make us evaporate, he would, because we are trying to get him out of power. So he sees us as the enemy. We see him as the enemy. And then on top of it, he's fighting ISIS. If you ever want to see a more confused situation, you'd be hard-pressed than to go to Syria. It's basically a country in a blender, and the blades are whirling around, and you're trying to make sense of what's happening. Is that an environment, do you think, where you can properly screen people? And we're not talking about 10 people. We're talking about a human stampede. A human stampede. And all you need is for a couple dozen terrorists to mix themselves in with hundreds of people. And I think the odds are that the numbers of terrorists will be far higher. Far higher. And if you look at most of the men getting on the trains and heading for Europe, the great majority of the people that are moving out are able-bodied young men, fighting-age men. What could possibly go wrong? Told that I really rattled the cage of those people in the council. But, I mean, it is remarkable. I provided these people, by the way, with copies of the quarterly journal known as The Social Contract. I wrote an article for The Social Contract looking back 14 years, the terror attacks of 9/11, the findings about immigration, and where we are today. I wrote the lead story. It's 27 pages long. By the way, if you go online, you can find it, The Social Contract, Summer Edition, 2015. I think you'll find it interesting. Well, I gave each one of the council members that journal, and I asked them to read it. Later that day, I confronted one of these guys in the parking lot. When I say confront, you know, I didn't get in his face. I just, you know, hi, how are you? And he shook hands with me. I said, I'd really appreciate it if you would kindly read the article, because if they didn't give me the time to articulate my concerns about terrorism the way I wanted to at this meeting, the article speaks for itself. And he was insistent that he had no reason to read anything. And I thought, you know, this is pretty amazing. And this wasn't the chairman. This was another yo-yo. And I said, this is truly amazing. All the guy had to do, he could have lied through his teeth. I mean, after all, he is a politician. He must think that he's a competent liar if he's nothing else. God help us all. And he was adamant. He said, well, why do you think I know how to read? I said, yeah, okay. Well, I said, actually, I wanted to say something. And I was trying to, you know, not get into a confrontation. I was trying to be persuasive. And I was there with some other folks from Spartanburg. And he absolutely made it clear that he had no intentions of reading that journal that he was holding in his hand. He walked out of the meeting with it. I said, you have it in your hand. I said, please, you know, just please read it at your convenience. Why would I do that? This is what we're dealing with. This is how they're being represented. And this guy represents a tiny little town. And he was so full of himself. And the people stood up there and they really told them off and basically said to them, come the next election, we're going to send you packing if you're not willing to listen to us. The arrogance that I witnessed in Spartanburg was in stark contrast with the hospitality and the respect shown to me by Trey Gowdy, who chairs the House Immigration Subcommittee and is heading up the investigation of Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. And I thought, wow. You know, Gowdy impressed me, not because he was being nice to me, you know, I don't care, but he really grasps the issue. I really think he's trying to do the right thing. But I listened to these guys from that local council, and the people were there, and they were very angry, very upset. And the arrogance that just oozed out of their pores, I have to tell you, something is terribly wrong with that picture. If ever you would imagine that politicians would be close to their constituents, it would be in a local county in a relatively urban area. And I have never seen greater arrogance, even when I've gone to Congress. And I said to these folks that I spoke with, why don't you vote these pieces of trash out? They need to leave. This is not representation. You know, my dad told me that I would teach people how I'm supposed to treat them by demonstrating what I'm willing to accept. Absolutely astonishing. I mean, beyond words, astonishing. You know, you sit there and you say, I can't believe what I'm witnessing. I can't believe what I'm hearing. And by the way, I've written some articles about it, but just to quote this, and then I want to just mention my latest article for Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org. I'm really proud to write for capsweb.org, for Front Page Magazine, Progressives for Immigration Reform, The Social Contract. I've really been a man on a mission since 9/11. And the people in Spartanburg felt bad about the way I was treated by the members of the council. And I was in someone's car, and they said, well, this is really embarrassing. I said, no, just imagine those fools sitting there with big rubber noses on their faces. I said, you just have to learn to move on, but you also need to do what you have to do to dump them out of their jobs so that they don't do this anymore. I said, because if there's an election and they're still in power, then they have every right to be abusive and contemptuous of you, because you've proven to them that you are their doormat and they could wipe their dirty boots on your face anytime they want. I said, what you need to do is vote them out of office. Maybe convince them to leave town altogether. I wouldn't want one of those yo-yos living next door to me. So really, folks, you know, if my program motivates you, if it fires you up, don't go to bed with a case of heartburn. Get involved in politics. You can't be a good parent if you're not involved in politics. But in any event, I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine, and it was called Refugee Crisis Must Not Undermine U.S. National Security. And the subtitle is Our Enemies Must Not Find in Our Compassion Weakness and Opportunities. So here's part of what I wrote. On November 10, 2014, Newsweek magazine published a disturbing report inside the CIA's Syrian rebels vetting machine. The article focused on the utter ineptitude in the program by which the CIA attempted to vet a force of only 5,000 Syrians they recruited to fight against the terrorists. And here's how the article begins. And I mean, this is remarkable. This is the Newsweek article. Nothing has come in for more mockery during the Obama administration's halting steps in the Syrian civil war than its employment of, quote, moderate to describe the kind of rebels it is willing to back. In one of the more widely cited japes, The New Yorker's resident humorist Andy Borowitz presented a, quote, moderate Syrian application form in which the applicants were asked to describe themselves as either A, moderate, B, very moderate, C, crazy moderate, D, other. After Senator John McCain allegedly posed with Syrians who are, quote, on our side, unquote, who turned out to be kidnappers, a report later called into question, John Stewart cracked, not everyone is going to be wearing their hello, I'm a terrorist name badge. Folks, we don't know who we're dealing with without a scorecard, and there are no scorecards, and the few scorecards that are out there may well be counterfeit. I mean, that's the situation we're in. That's the situation that we are in. And that's really what people need to be focused on. It's really critically important. The article that I wrote for CAPSWeb.org, C-A-P-S, they just published it today, just this afternoon. The title, Presidential Candidates Tap Dance Around the Need for Effective Enforcement of Our Immigration Laws. I had a little bit of fun writing it. I have a twisted brain. I think those of you who are familiar with my writing and my radio program and my appearances know that I do have a somewhat warped sense of humor. It's the only way I could keep whatever shreds of sanity I still possess. If I lose my sense of humor, I fear that my mind won't be far behind. But I looked at three of the candidates. And I have to tell you, I'm only going to talk about Christie tonight. And you can read the article and see who else I wrote about and how I dissected what they had to say. I think you'll probably find yourself in agreement, but that's up to you. But you got to go to capsweb.org. You got to look for my commentary for their blog. But Christie said that we need to have someone tap illegal aliens on the shoulder who overstay their visa and remind them that they are supposed to go home. That was his quote. That was his quote. It was remarkable because Christie said that we need to get FedEx to track these illegal aliens because they're able to track packages. Well, you'd be amazed at who has been doing the job for a $10 billion contract. That goes back more than 10 years, and we still don't know who's leaving the United States. $10 billion. Look, it's not about the corporations doing the job better than the government. It's about the agenda, because if we knew who was staying over the period of time, we would have to yank countries out of the visa waiver program, and that runs contrary to what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce wants and their Discover America partnership want, because one of the components for a country, or one of the requirements for a country to participate in the visa waiver program, is their citizens cannot overstay their visas by more than, I don't know if it's 2 or 3 or 4%, it's a small number. Same thing with the overstay, the visa denial rate. Well, visa denial rates can be screwed around with. Consular officials are told, give more visas. Stop paying so much attention to these people. I mean, that's how you wind up with millions and millions and millions of overstayed aliens and aliens who violated the terms of their admission. There must be something wrong with the process when nearly as many illegal aliens in our country are believed to have come through the front door, not run our border, which is why the absurdity is to keep talking about just securing the Mexican border. That's why I wrote an article for Front Page that I called Border Security and the Immigration Colander. We're being hoodwinked into believing that if you just secure the Mexican border, that everything else will be fine. It's one of the biggest lies in the world, next to the check is in the mail, and I can think of a couple of other such lies. No, I mean, this is an absurdity. It's offensive because it makes presumptions that we're stupid, and all too many times, people are dumb. I mean, I go to town hall meetings, and the people who read my stuff, I'll say, how many border states do we have? And people, if they're familiar with me, will say, 50, immediately. And I can tell if they've never read my stuff because they sit there looking at the fingers on their hands and they're going, well, there's New Mexico, there's California. And I say, well, yeah, you're telling me about the Mexican border. Is that the only way to come into the United States? They start scratching their head. We really need to pay attention. We need to educate our neighbors. That's why I've created what I call my Bucket Brigade of Truth. I mean, when you have Christie saying, we need to tap people on the shoulder. But yet when the discussion turned to marijuana, I'm a prosecutor, I'm going to put people in jail, and I don't care if the local law says you can have marijuana. If it's against the federal law, I'm going to prosecute them. Christie said that. Well, there are laws about immigration, too. When Christie was asked, for example, about where he stands on the anchor baby question, he said, oh, that's a distraction. The question is a distraction. Still didn't give his opinion. He just said that the question was a distraction. A distraction from what? The truth, Christie? I mean, give me a break. See, this is the kind of stuff that we keep hearing all the time. So, I'll just read my own paragraph, one paragraph, but you have to read the whole article to get everything else. I think you're going to like it, capsweb.org. What I said here is that I wonder, well, let me back up a little bit. Let me just read this whole paragraph. Governor Christie has repeatedly stated that he had previously been a tough federal prosecutor, and that if anyone should understand how law enforcement works, you would think it would be Mr. Christie. I wonder if he is willing to order his state police to stop speeding motorists, tap the driver on the shoulder to remind the driver of the speed limit that he or she was exceeding. And then I ask, would Christie be willing to have police simply tap a burglar on his shoulder and remind the offender that he should not have broken into someone else's home? What do you mean, tap someone on the shoulder? As an immigration agent, if you overstayed your visa, if you were admitted into the United States to attend a school and did not attend, if you were admitted to do a job and didn't go to that job, let's say agricultural workers, we didn't tap them on the shoulder, we handcuffed them. You see, it's all about sounding tough. Oh, it's not just the Mexican border. Listen, we're having a crisis in America. We're having a crisis in America. The remittances, the money being wired out of our country by foreign workers, legal and illegal, amounts to probably more than $200 billion a year. And I say probably because they used to publish the statistics on the UN and at the World Bank websites. They don't anymore. They don't publish it. It used to be that half the remittances that flowed from the first world to the third world came out of the U.S. economy. Last year, there's varying numbers also. It's amazing how all these statistics are all over the map. But well over $500 billion got wired to the third world from the first world by foreign workers. And by the way, guess which country gets the greatest amount of money wired home? Last year, folks, it was India, over $70 billion. Not just from America, but principally from America. China, then Mexico, then other countries. It's a huge amount of money moving around the world. And the banks love it. They do, because they're a moving company and they get their little cut, they get their commission for moving the money. They don't care if the money comes from a guy working in a factory. They don't care if it's because of a visiting professor who's teaching a class. They don't care if it's a girl working in a brothel or a drug dealer who just sold a couple of kilos of heroin or cocaine. They don't care. They just want to move the money so they can charge you the fee. if you look at $200 billion, and I think that's a conservative estimate as to how much money is leaving our country in remittances, and you factor in something known as the multiplier effect. See, the idea behind the multiplier effect is that if you earn a dollar, you spend it, and other people in turn will spend money. So the idea is that $1 generates $3 in business ultimately. So if you pull the money out of the economy, the reverse happens. So suddenly, $200 billion has the functional equivalent of taking a half trillion, more than a half trillion, $600 billion out of our economy. And you know what, folks? Our national debt grows by a half trillion a year, simply enforcing our immigration laws and getting rid of the remittances would more than make up for the growth of our national debt. Enforcing our immigration laws is not only affordable, but it would actually give us a net gain. So when politicians talk about, oh, we can't afford to do this, it's too expensive, bull. We would save so much money and we would be so much safer that America would start to erase the national debt. So when you hear some politician making those statements, give them the business card of a good plastic surgeon you know who specializes in rhinoplasty, because that politician just joined the Pinocchio Club and his nose is growing. It's all these lies about what they can't do and won't do, and it's not nice, and we're not compassionate. And listen, it's time that our politicians showed compassion for we the people. It's time the politicians showed concern for the survival of our nation. And until that day comes, we're going to be in deep trouble. No other country on the face of the earth has reacted to these issues the way the current crop of politicians has. I'm hopeful that by doing what I did in Spartanburg, that maybe we're going to convince those yo-yos on the city council or the county council to change their way of thinking. But I can tell you there's a lot of very angry people walking around Spartanburg right now, and they are making it clear to everybody that they are in a state of pissed off, and it's understandable. They need to be represented. They are supposed to be represented. They need to demand that they get that representation that they, by law, are entitled to. And God knows I may be going back there or to other communities, but we need to hold our government accountable. I go back to my dad's teaching that I would teach people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I was willing to accept. And he told me, he said, Mike, and he had that real serious look on his face, if people treat you as a doormat, you have no one to blame but yourself. And you see, my dad's biggest problem, and he had a big problem, was that he was the nicest guy in the world and never had the ability to say no to anybody. So people took such advantage of him, it broke my heart. It frustrated him and it broke my heart. We need to do better for ourselves and we need to do better for our children. And that's why I do this program. I am determined, I really am, to convince everybody out there to please get involved. Please make the politicians accountable. The future of our children and their children, the future of our country are all on the line. You know, I always like to remind people that democracy is not a spectator sport, and indeed it's not. So I thank you for joining me. I hope you will visit capsweb.org and check out that article, Front Page Magazine, Progressives for Immigration Reform, The Social Contract. But most important, folks, please get involved. Please make that difference. And share the information that I provide you with as many neighbors as you can. I'm trying to create a bucket brigade of truth. Have a great weekend, everybody. I look forward again to seeing you next week, right here, same time, on the Michael Cutler Hour. Good night, everybody.